Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to Series 2 of my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen. A podcast made in collaboration with my friends at the amazing charity Help Musicians. For those who don't know, Help Musicians was originally founded over 100 years ago by Edward Elgar, Vaughan Williams and some of their mates, with the aim to raise money for a musician friend that had sadly died and the family couldn't afford to bury him. Since then, they've expanded to provide support to thousands and thousands of musicians. They supply assistance with mental health and they provide financial support too. They have a wonderful mentoring scheme, developing skills and collaborating with fellow musicians. Throughout the pandemic, Help Musicians have provided £19.3 million to over 20,000 musicians. I find that absolutely inspiring. In this episode, I've got together with a young man whose musical vision and curiosity has taken him not only to the top of the UK charts, but also to the upper reaches of the American charts. He's worked with fine artists such as Graham Coxon, Craig David, and Rudimental. And his band's latest release is a heady concept album. Please welcome Dan Smith, better known as Bastille. Hey Dan, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast for Help Musicians. How you keeping?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks. We're currently rehearsing for a tour that we're about to go on in a week yesterday. But yeah, other than that, I'm good. It's nice to be back with everybody and, you know, with all the crew who've had such a rough time over the last couple of years. And yeah, and the idea of heading back out on a tour is pretty surreal. But yeah, very exciting. And yeah, really happy to be here chatting to you as well.
Oh, that's cool. But you're going to be in a tight bubble when you're out on the road, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we will, you know, just got to be as sensible as possible and make sure everyone's looked after. But yeah, it's innately quite wild going from the sort of levels of isolation that everyone's been conditioned to over the last couple of years. Obviously things have sort of opened up slowly, but to just straight into rooms full of packed people. These aren't our first gigs. We've done a bunch of shows since kind of last summer, but yeah, this is the first sort of proper big tour.
What was the excitement level like when you first started out and you first walked out on stage with playing songs?
Ever,
yeah. Was it like amazing?
That's a good question. So I have quite a weird relationship with playing live, in that for me, I'm sort of primarily quite a kind of introverted, awkward bedroom musician that likes to, I love writing songs. It's my favorite thing in the whole, like it's, I would happily do it all day, every day. And I think, you know, the band for me was kind of the sort of natural outlet for the songs that I was writing. And initially I used to make music on a 12 track that I had. And I only ever played a gig. I was at university, I was at Leeds University, and my mate heard some of my songs and entered me into this amazing competition that Leeds Council used to run, where they would, every year, they'd pick sort of 10 artists and musicians and would... Are you picking up loads of drums, by the way?
That's okay, don't worry.
Okay, sorry. It's quite a thin bit of glass between me and our drummer who's line checking, which is potentially one of the most annoying sounds in the world.
Potentially, I agree.
Sorry, very boring long story, but I was sort of in this position suddenly at uni where I had this gig that I had to play and I had never really played a gig before. And I had all these songs that were with me kind of layered up because I was using this 12 track and I was like, oh God, I've got to figure out how to do these live. And I was working, I was at uni, I was doing shifts at the student bar where they had like the refectory at Leeds where they had loads of gigs, which was amazing because you got to like pour pints and then just watch gigs. But I saw an artist with a loop pedal and was like, oh, that's a way to do it. And sort of, and saved up to get one of those, a really sort of like quite simple one, but it allowed me to plug my voice and my piano into this loop pedal and just layer and layer and layer live all of this stuff that I've been doing on record. But doing that in my bedroom was one thing, doing that on a stage was another, and I just have the worst stage fright. Like, I'm not an extrovert, and the idea of being up on the stage in front of lots of people is not something that is super like natural to me. Yeah. So I used to get hammered. I used to just have to drink like a couple of bottles of wine or
sounds
whatever
familiar.
Else.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd get up on stage and that's, you know, obviously it's not like the healthiest habit to get into. And luckily it's not one that stuck around. But
yeah.
Also the biggest nightmare was having to coordinate and loop the timings of yourself and harmonies and all these layers whilst you're shit-faced. Me trying to like stay in time with myself, on these pedals and play on these instruments. Like, you know, it wasn't putting myself in the best light. But yeah. That's just what it took at the beginning. So for me, initially, getting out on stage, it wasn't some sort of big, I've always dreamed of this glorious moment of stepping out on stage. You know, it's I know it sounds silly, but it was kind of traumatic in a weird way. I think people just come at this from different angles, don't they? Some people want to be in a band to like make friends or sleep around. Some people will do it because they desperately love making music. Some people do it because they just want to be up on stage and be adored. Some people want to be famous. Like, there's so many different reasons. I happen to just be really nerdy songwriter that just, you know, it was a kind of outlet for these songs I was making and still is. And obviously it became like all the guys that we're all like such good friends and I love.
Oh my God, the drummer's gone mad.
Let me find somewhere.
It's always a drummer.
Give me 1 second. Sorry. All right, I've asked. I put the request in.
Let's see. Okay, see how it goes down, yeah?
Yeah.
So when you were at school, who was your favourite teacher, the one that inspired you the most?
Ooh, that's a good question. I had a English teacher, actually, who he got us reading a book by Ian McEwan called A Child in Time. Mm. And I think it was just, well, it was him. And then also we had a couple of art teachers who were amazing. I thought at school, sort of being drawn out of what you expect maybe from school. You know, I think in English it was like the classics, the maybe slightly, obviously amazing, but harder to read, harder to identify with, slightly turgid and, you know, superficially inaccessible literature. I think having someone who was maybe a bit younger and just kind of leveled with us and really drew us into the world of this book and all of its complexities, that was kind of amazing. And then I think there was an art teacher we had called Miss Gillard who just really empowered us all. I think what I thought was amazing when I was at school doing art was how much freedom you had. You know, at kind of GCSE and A-level, you were basically just given a word at the beginning of the year or the term and or a phrase and told to just run with it.
Wow.
And I'm not sure what the curriculum is like now, but, you know, I think that's pretty much as close to kind of independent learning as you can get. So you'd have like a term to explore. What did that make you think about? Do loads of research into other artists that exist. Just go off and do it. You'd fill up this sketchbook with all of your thoughts and your ramblings, and you'd end with having to do an exam and a final piece. And, you know, that is so, I think, such a kind of like nice, exciting, bold way to allow young people to go off and explore things, you know, hopefully with a bit of a guiding hand.
Sure. Did that lean you towards writing songs in the first place?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't really imagine being in a band. And I definitely didn't sort of idealise and like fetishise that lifestyle or, you know, what it could be. I obviously loved music a lot, but it just didn't occur to me to be in a band, you know, like as I've described. Definitely not the kind of person that like was gagging for attention. I very much wanted to like shy away. So was yeah, I guess I really was obsessed with film. I really wanted to be a filmmaker, but was probably not quite, I don't know, go get them enough to do it. So all the things I did, like I loved making art, I loved making songs, but it was, you know, I'd be mortified at the idea of anyone hearing them. I think it was just the idea of like being able to try and build little worlds. And that was the thing with the art as well. Like, as we've gone on as a band, our albums have become much more conceptual. And I think it's because, for me, it's really fun to set out to make a body of work, have parameters that exist, and then within those parameters, within those boundaries that you set, you can kind of push and explore as much as possible. It's almost sometimes more creative.
Yeah. Is there a band that you admire that has that kind of conceptual touch?
Well, when I was sort of starting to play as a musician, I really admired... I loved Regina Spektor. I thought she was really interesting in how kind of narrative and conceptual all of her songs were. I was really drawn to artists that created these sort of these worlds. I loved like Sufjan Stevens so much, and you know, his Illinois album, the idea of, you know, taking a state and trying to give an impression of its history and its complexities through the lyrics and the sound. I thought that was amazing. Anthony and the Johnsons as well. That I'm a Bird Now album, I just thought was extraordinary. I think I was really drawn to people who had sort of strange and quite unique voices and who just were kind of unashamedly themselves. And through the music they made, the production, the sounds and their lyrics, you know, created a story, created a world. So, yeah.
Were your parents of the supportive kind when you were starting writing songs and listening to that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they had quite a sort of strong work ethic. And I think when they saw... I went to university and, you know, and always worked and stuff as well. So I think when they saw... I moved back to London after university in Leeds and was, you know, holding down a full-time job and doing gigging and temping as well. And they were really encouraging. I think when they saw how seriously I was taking it, yeah, they were amazing, actually. They, you know, at one point they said, you're living, like, on the other side of London, you know, working all day to basically pay rent to then do gigs at night. Why don't you just move home, get a part-time job and spend more time on your music and not have to pay rent? So I actually moved back with them for like a year, which was amazing. That's such a huge privilege to have, you know, parents who are that sort of supportive and who have a spare room, you know.
Absolutely amazing. And you got your washing done, I suspect.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I do it myself as well, but yeah, that's the perks.
Was there music around the house? What sort of things did your mum and dad listen to?
Yeah, there was a lot of music. So my mum and dad are from South Africa and they both studied there. And, you know, like a lot of people from their generation were, you know, hugely anti-apartheid. And amongst their friends who were, you know, students at the time, a lot of people, you know, were kind of activists and some sort of were kind of imprisoned in protesting. And, you know, and imagine growing up in a oppressive racist regime like that, you know, I think it was obviously really confusing and complicated in a lot of ways. And a lot of people from that generation left. So they came to the UK and was kind of retrained here and built a life here. But my mom was also a folk singer and she used to do like beautiful, like Joan Baez covers and Dylan covers and basically paid her way through university by also being quite big on the like Durban folk scene. And that world was one, the world that she occupied of mainly sort of playing traditional songs and kind of covers and stuff. So that's always been there. And her sort of identity in her career is so different to that and was so different to that. But you know, she'd always pick up the guitar and be playing music, you know, when friends would come out for dinner or whatever. And they just loved, like, Simon and Garfunkel, Beach Boys, like the Beatles, just a bunch of little known bands. But like, I think of like Paul Simon's Graceland was a huge record in our house when we were kids and a real mix, like classical as well. So I think I was kind of like brought up with music like that and kind of Elton John in the background, these like big songwriters with these, you know, these amazing, memorable songs and harmonies, like just harmonies everywhere. And my sister was really into hip hop, so there was that in the house as well. Which
an
was
amazing mix, yeah. Did your mum ever record any of that, her singing?
Not properly, no, as in like quote unquote properly, but I think there's an amazing tape that exists where she just sang for like a few hours and it's on a tape somewhere. And actually one of the first songs, when I first started writing, I didn't really have a voice lyrically, as I'm sure some people experience. I didn't know, I was like, I've got all these melodies, but I don't really know what to say. I was just like an idiot, relatively sheltered teenager that didn't want to write about angst or, you know. And so my first window into songwriting, I had a friend who lived up the road and she was writing some very moody teenage poetry that she let me turn into songs, which was quite
amazing.
Fun. So the first few songs I wrote were channeling my friend. And also my dad uncovered this book of poems that he'd written.
Wow.
When him and my mum were like, after they left South Africa, they moved to America and they sort of traveled around America for a while before they then moved to the UK and settled here. And so he had all these poems and there's a song called Telegraph Road that he wrote about being in San Francisco and this homeless lady surrounded by her dogs. And I actually ended up taking that and turning it into a song. And then I got my mum to do all the harmonies on the chorus. And that was one of the tunes I first recorded on this sort of 12 track of mine. So
how beautiful.
So yeah, I guess in a way.
What an amazing thing. God, I'd love to hear that.
I want to bring that back, actually.
You should, yeah. So it must be really a thrill for you going out on stage with your band now. What was the first live band that you went to see that really sort of mesmerised you and thought, this is something I'd like to do? I know you were very introverted, but there must have been a moment when it clicked.
Yeah, I went through like a metal phase when I was a kid. Live gigs initially for me were like just quite loud and moshy, but as I settled into calmer music taste as I was a sort of later teenager, and I remember seeing Ray LaMontagne play live. He had an album called Trouble, and it was just him and a guitar, and he was seemingly such an introvert, and it wasn't about stagecraft. It was just, he got up there, you could have heard a pin drop, and had this song called Burn, and I think it was Manchester or something, in one of the academies, and he just strums the first couple of chords, and his voice opens, and he sings like "Oh Mama," the opening lines, in this like desperate rasp, and like just hairs on the back of my neck. It was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever heard, and that whole gig was just, you know, just this room full of people in silent awe of this guy, and it was so minimal and so stripped. I remember also at the same kind of time seeing Regina Spektor and this like this incredible, talented, powerful woman at the piano who was just so great at, so such a sort of interesting, complex musician, but her voice is beautiful, and these songs are kind of, they're totally mad and bizarre, and they cut through just all these lives and stories. Yeah. It was those gigs to me were kind of mesmerizing, and it's because of the vulnerability of them and these artists who just, they're, like I said before, kind of being unashamedly themselves, telling these stories and managing to hold a whole crowd of people with just, you know, the real, like, pure basics of what they do.
Do you manage to bring that vulnerability to your shows now?
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask that. So I guess for me and Bastille, like, it's always been as much about production as it has been about the songwriting process for me. Like, as soon as I start writing, I also start producing. And so, you know, this tour we're doing at the moment, like, we just made an album that's basically a science fiction. And it's going to be, you know, big production, lots of kind of electronics and instruments and loads of synths and a lot going on. And it's kind of the opposite of that. But both because it's really fun to do that, you know, and we really enjoy trying different stuff. But also, if there's an element of, like, in everything we do, in the production and all the things around it, of how can I bury myself? How can I pretend I'm not here a little bit? And it's that thing of, you know, I love writing songs in the traditional sense, but I also really love production and exploring music. So I think with our band, we always try and do quite a lot of different things, potentially too many things at once. But at the same time, we've been making this very sort of futuristic album. And then we were asked to do an MTV Unplugged gig, which kind of forced us in the space of like 2 weeks to just strip everything back to just acoustic instruments and choir. And I loved it so much. It was such an amazing experience for us. And it's quite exposing, you know, sort of ripping everything away from the songs, some songs that people know, a lot that people don't, but, you know, and doing them just with an acoustic guitar. But for me, there's a bunch of moments in this set for this new tour where we strip it right back to just a guitar and a vocal, or one instrument and a vocal. And I feel like they're definitely my favourite parts. You're not sort of competing or fighting with anything else. Yeah. You get to sort of just relax into it and sing those songs.
So with Genesis retiring, you're filling their space, it sounds like.
That would be nice, but very much not happening. How about you? How what was your first live experience? Was it amazing? Was it everything you wanted? Was it...
I was just thinking, very similar. I went to see David Bowie, who...
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. That's amazing.
In 1971, he played on his own for about 25 minutes, played the Jacques Brel songs and songs he'd written. It was very powerful. And that intimacy and that energy that he had was like, yeah, I want to be a songwriter. You know, he brought that very much into focus for me. And then he brought the band on stage and they made a hell of a record and it was amazing. So there was, yeah, very similar. I was sort of opened up by the simplicity of great songs.
Mm. Amazing. I can't believe that's such an amazing...
Yeah, it was in a local college. I remember walking home from it thinking, this is what I want to do. And that's what I ended up doing. So it was pretty cool.
Oh, amazing. That's so awesome.
Of course, I was never as thin as David Bowie, but I had a good go at it for a while. Alongside my guests, in each episode, we also like to feature the story of a musician who has benefited from Help Musicians and whose career has been supported or even saved by the charity.
I am Rebecca Rose Harris, and I'm from an outfit called Smana, and we are multidisciplinary artists that weave together our analogue mediums of music, film, photography, poetry and fine art into one immersive project. We manage all of our creations in-house where we are here in West Wales at our studio, The Road Records, and we draw a huge amount of inspiration from the landscape around us. My personal journey with music actually started when my father died and I bought a second-hand guitar that I later discovered was previously owned by Mystic Woman. So I started transforming my poetry into songs, and Franklin gravitated towards music at a very young age, weaving together very lucid multi-instrumental compositions. But together, our musical journey began when we fell in love and we bought an old van and we undertook what was to become a year-long journey across the natural wilderness and distant cities of Eastern Europe. And the first creations that we made together were written in vast isolations of forests, rivers, mountains, and we would then take those creations and perform them on the streets and the towns and the cities and the villages that we passed through. When we went away on that trip, we took a limited selection of albums and homemade compilation CDs. People like Jeff Buckley, Nick Cave, Bert Jansch, Daniel Rosson, Leonard Cohen, Patti Smith, to name a few. There have been many high points in terms of accomplishments, but for me personally, those defining moments are when a very profound connection is established between myself and audience members. One that comes straight to mind, when we played at the Montpellier Opera House in France. Franklin and I, we always play barefoot because it's just our natural way of rooting. It was an amazing show. The energy in that room was incredibly charged and profound. And I remember at the end, there was a young man and he was standing before me and he had his hand on his heart and he just looked straight at me. No words were exchanged, but we just held each other's gaze for what felt like quite a long time. And it was the emotion that he was carrying and that he was projecting. He had his shoes in his hands and he was barefoot. And I remember he walked out of that opera house barefoot, and there were these huge glass windows behind us on the stage. And I remember keeping my eyes on him, and he just walked all the way down the street until I couldn't see him anymore. And the whole time he had his shoes in his hand. And it's for me, moments like that, they really, really resonate with me. That's the powerful highlight, really, for us both. So we initially found out about Help Musicians through the Corona Hardship Fund. We can't really begin to express our gratitude towards Help Musicians because they've been phenomenal in providing us with both financial and emotional support. For all creatives, this whole ordeal has been incredibly difficult because we fell through all the nets, all of those nets that the government provided. It's charities such as Help Musicians that they remind you as a creative that there are organisations and there are people that really care about the arts and they care about sustaining the well-being of the people that create the work. Have trust and faith in yourself, your power, your creations and your journey, because even if you carry a lot of pride, you might be very, very surprised by the amount of hope that you can receive and the amount of compassion that you can receive. It's that fusion of you stepping out into life and life greeting you.
To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information, and please subscribe to this podcast. So when you formed the band, was that like a bunch of mates that you knew from around where you lived, or was it sort of just a fortunate coming together?
Yeah, it was kind of unfortunate coming together. Growing up, I just didn't really know musicians, and there wasn't, like, around where I was, there was a bit of a music scene, but I just wasn't confident enough and didn't want it enough to go out and seek it. Mm. But having had that experience at university and done this gig where I'd sort of, you know, I say being forced to, obviously no one was forcing me, but I'd sort of, I found myself having to do the show for the first time and finding it really scary and stressful, but I must have been something in me that you know, that fed off it and enjoyed it enough to want to pursue it. I moved back to London. I was playing shows by myself. And then, yeah, met Woody, our drummer, who lived a couple of roads away. He was actually flying for, he was a drum teacher and he was flying for drum lessons. And I was like, I'll give him a shout. He might have some students that like have a bit of free time and want to drum with me. And he was like, I'll do it. So we became mates and started playing together. And then Kyle was like a friend of a friend who I'd see all the time at parties and would be like, oh, I'm starting this band, like after quite a lot of drinks. Do you want to join? And I think after like the fifth time of asking, he was like, I might just give him a call back and see what this is about. So yeah, and Will, we again met through another friend as well. Mm-hmm. So it took a kind of while to form, and it was sort of coalescing around stuff I was doing by myself as Dan Smith. And it was when Kyle joined, I was like, no, this is a band. And I'm much more comfortable and excited about the idea of it being a band. And I think with Bastille initially, it was kind of intentionally confusing. You know, we didn't do like press photos or band photos. It was all trying to be as kind of, I don't know, not mysterious, because obviously we're not mysterious at all, but it was sort of seeking to be a bit confusing. Yeah. And I think the songs with these weird creations that we made on my laptop, you know, a lot of it, that first album I sort of wrote in my bedroom and ended up kind of working on the production with a friend in his basement. And it was all about imagination. So for me, the songs were like dreaming of running through a forest in David Lynch's Twin Peaks, or you know, thinking of Pompeii and bizarrely and kind of totally ridiculously equating the stasis I was feeling in my life with the stasis of these people who've stuck in this same position for eternity. And, you know, the stories of like Icarus and myths, and it was about escapism, and it was about putting the headphones on, writing these songs and layering and layering and layering and using these sounds that you could, you know, create digitally to sort of take us and me and our heads somewhere so far away. So then the challenge for us as a four piece was then like, right, how do we do this with the four of us again, you know, live in pubs and you know, toilet venue spaces up and down the country?
Yeah. What did lockdown do for you?
So, yeah, so we pretty much toured nonstop since we started, and we did sort of three albums, four mixtapes, a huge like reorchestrated project, pretty much nonstop touring for each of the albums and everything. We never really had a break. And whenever we'd come home, I'd go straight into the studio to try and work on, you know, new music, new albums, writing for other people, all that kind of stuff. And so lockdown for me, bizarrely, came at a point. We'd planned from March of 2020 to have a year out with no touring, and I was going to take some time off and try and make an album, but sort of luxuriate in the process a bit. So, you know, I think mentally we were kind of prepared for some sort of stop. Obviously, it wasn't that. Lockdown for me, when it began, we'd sort of started making an album. So things were kind of brewing. I'd written loads of songs. I'd started recording a bunch as well, stuff we were really excited about. And for me, it just, I don't know, it was weird. Obviously, it was stressful and it was kind of scary in a lot of ways, but it was also weirdly freeing. I think the idea that any pressure to really do anything kind of disappeared, and it was just about existing. So I ended up doing quite a lot of volunteering. I was working at a food bank a few days a week.
Well done, Dan.
And that NHS volunteering scheme, just because suddenly having the time to do that was really nice. But then also I was running a film club, which was quite a lot of work. And then also just writing and working on this album. It just freed up. I was sort of doing other things in the day, and then in the evenings we'd get home and, you know, or go upstairs because we were all basically in our houses most of the time and just be writing. And it kind of reminded me of, you know, pre-Bastille when I was working all day and then would just work on songs all night because I just loved it. It didn't matter what happened to them or where they went. So I guess the lockdowns for me were really creative. I think the sort of, not the touring is a distraction, it's so much more than that, but the kind of, as you know, when you're busy with it, it just consumes so much of your life and so much of your time. And with that going away, it kind of freed me up to, you know, we wrote this Bastille album that we've just released, which has another sort of full album going on the end of it. And then I wrote another record as well and started a project with a friend and was doing a lot of writing for other people. And so it was hugely productive for me. It kind of allowed me to have a glimpse into what I might have done or be doing if we weren't busy as a band. And I noticed, and it, obviously it was different for everyone. Some people's creativity completely stops and they're like, oh, I don't want to be creating right now. And others lent into it. What about you? How was it for you?
like that. I mean, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to create, but I started working with help musicians. And as a charity during that time, they gave out £20 million to songwriters who were on their arse. And here I am at a songwriting retreat with 15 of those songwriters that were on their arse. And it was amazing. We did these workshops online, so I got to meet all these people on Zoom, but not in real life. And this week has been the first time I've met them, and it's been quite an amazing thing. So the charity is speaks for itself. Have you ever been aware of it at all?
No, I'm not. I'm embarrassingly so. I've never heard of them, but it sounds incredible. It sounds like they do such amazing work.
Yeah, they've been going for 100 years, 101 years.
Wow.
And they're really great. So it's nice to have that. You know, I think we're one of the few industries that has that kind of place where you can fall.
Yeah, that's amazing. Sorry for my complete naivety. Is that songwriters across kind of all spheres of music?
We're talking about musicians from timpani players to lead singers to drummers. I mean, everybody. I've been online with so many different people, classical pianists, opera singers, R&B writers. So yeah, it goes right across the board. So you go online and you apply for a grant, basically, and you have to explain what that grant is for. Yeah, so it
that's
works
amazing.
Really well.
That's such an amazing resource. Yeah, particularly, you know, given the creative industries were just abandoned and continue to be abandoned by this government.
But,
throughout the pandemic, you know, not just songwriters, but looking at, you know, in the live world, you know, all these freelance crew who pay their taxes and work their asses off the entire time were just completely, completely left out in the cold whilst so many other industries were supported and people were furloughed. It was really difficult to see. And obviously this is an unprecedented situation and it's hard to get everything right, but it was just shocking, you know, given how vital the UK's creative industries are. And, you know, we're known for them. We're known for music. We're known for the impact that has globally. And for that not to be like cherished and nurtured and protected in the context of so many other countries who are doing such incredible things for creatives and musicians, you know, it's shocking. But amazing that this organization exists. That's incredible.
You know, like you were saying, people in our road crew, one of the guys who works for us, he was driving a Sainsbury's van for like a year. And, you know, for him to come back out on the road was a dodgy moment for him. He didn't know whether he needed the security of still driving the van or coming out on the road, but he came back out on the road, thank God.
Yeah, we have exactly the same. I mean, you know, we've had the same crew for like nearly 10 years. And, the anniversary of our first album is, the 10-year anniversary is next year.
Fantastic.
So a lot of them have been with us for such a long time and are like family. And when the pandemic hit, you know, we weren't going to be on tour. So some of them had other work organised, you know, as happens.
Yeah.
But yeah, we did our best to support everyone as best as we could. But obviously everything stopped for everyone. And they all became like supermarket delivery drivers. And that is obviously an important and noble profession in itself, but just the idea that in so many other walks of life and in so many other industries, if your job stopped, you were then supported.
Yeah.
It was just wild that in this particular industry, if your job stopped, you were completely fucked unless you went out and just had to get a new job and work probably twice as hard to be able to support your family. Yeah, it was really sad, but it makes it all the more, like you said, it's kind of complex, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because everyone has to realign, readjust, their lives change. And it's a big step going back out into being away all the time, particularly if you've suddenly been around with your family or whoever, you know, for ages.
So if you've ever been in a really dark space, who's the person that you lean on the most for hope and encouragement?
That's a really good question. I guess I have friends who are... Yeah, I've got like a bunch of really close friends who are pretty amazing in that they are not remotely involved. Like none of my mates are really working music or the creative industries. So there's a real perspective there.
That's nice. That's really nice.
Which is lovely. Yeah. And my family, I'm really close with my sister. She is very thoughtful and understanding. She's really funny, but she also happens to be a therapist, which is
not that she would ever give me therapy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But it says a lot about how thoughtful she is. I've been very lucky to be, you know, surrounded by friends and family, and you know, all the people that we tour with are lovely as well. I think it's interesting traveling with a group of, you know, predominantly, as is the way unfortunately in the touring industry, predominantly male colleagues. There's a kind of like stigma around talking and being open if you're having a dark time and if things are difficult. I think increasingly as the years have gone by, people feel more able to hopefully talk about the things that are affecting them. And I think particularly, you know, in music and in the live industry, there are loads of great kind of charities and organizations that have sort of popped up to try and help people in their darkest times. But you know, you just never know what someone else is going through, do you? And you don't know what's going on in their heads.
You don't, unless you ask, of course. Dan, if you were to get in a spaceship tomorrow and go to the moon, what record would you take with you?
Oh, that's such a good question.
Let's hope they've got record players up on the moon.
Yeah, exactly. Which Bowie record would it be? I don't know. I think, would I be like jamming out to Graceland? Would it be like... I love, when we were growing up, we just listened to Bridge Over Troubled Waters all the time. And I always thought that was like a greatest hits album, but actually it's not. And that's such an incredible record in terms, you know, just the sounds and the harmonies are beautiful. 2001 by Dr. Dre. That is a pretty incredible record from top to bottom. Yeah. Oh God, what would it be? Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy by Kanye, Blonde by Frank Ocean. Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. That would be awesome. Except maybe the interludes would start to piss me off a little bit. If that was the only record I could listen to. There's just too many to choose from. I don't know. I'd probably cheat and go for something massive, like a big deluxe box set. What about you? What would be your record?
Blimey, that's a good question, Dan. I don't know.
It's hard when the tables are turned, isn't it?
I know, it really is, you bastard. Probably be a Joni Mitchell record. I really like the record she went in and she did the covers of her own tracks with orchestration. That was an amazing record. So you're on the spaceship and you're coming back to Earth with that record. And you had your pick of live artists and festival to go to. Who would you want to see and where?
God, Glastonbury. I would basically just try and recreate Glastonbury because it's my favourite. Place in the world and my favourite weekend in the world. I think the lineup this year looks pretty exciting.
Are you going?
Yeah. We are not to play, just to hang out.
I'll see you there.
Which is amazing. I'll see you there. I'm so excited. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd want to get a huge mix. I mean, is it dead or alive, or is it just alive?
Hey, why not dead as well?
Oh, God. Well, Bowie headlining, obviously.
Yes, obviously.
Prince would be pretty great to see. Aretha Franklin.
He never did Glastonbury, did he?
I know. I think like it would be great to see Dave play. I think he's pretty incredible.
Too. What a lyricist.
Lil Sims, as well. Like Frank Ocean, 100%. Get him to play for four hours. Who else? Kendrick would be amazing. He's this like extraordinary artist. Enoni, I'd love to see. The list would go on and on and on and on. Vampire Weekend, I think, are fantastic.
Yeah. So are you a disciplined bunch? You know, you're in a rehearsal room. It's 9:30 in the morning, so to speak, and it looks like you're getting ready for a day's work. Are you a disciplined crowd?
We have to be because it's our last day of rehearsals in this space before our tour starts next week, so we don't really have a choice. It's work. Yeah, we've been working pretty hard this week, and I think I've got like my parents' work ethic, so
good for you.
I pretty much just work all the time, but like it's not work, is it? Elements of it are a bit of a grind, and elements of it aren't that fun, but then I get to write songs, I get to do my favorite thing in the world for me, for other people. Like, I've loved writing with other artists, for other artists. It's so nice. It's not about you. It's, you know, you're just there to serve. You're there to be useful. You're there to put ideas in. There is nothing more incredible than being in a writing session and that moment where everyone starts to feel excited by the ideas that are flying around. You're all like working together to pull this song together. It's just the most, it's the best feeling.
Hey, Dan, do you know the festival song by David Bowie?
Which song?
It's the Memory of a Free Festival.
No, we'll listen to it as soon as we hang up.
Yeah, you've got to listen to it, because I'm doing a show at Glastonbury, which is in memory of the festival itself. So if you know that song and you want to get up and sing it, you're welcome to.
I'd love to. Yeah, that'd be awesome. When's your show?
It's on the Saturday afternoon. It's mainly a story about going to festivals over time, and I've been going to the festival since it began, so I've got lots of stories to tell.
I bet
of course,
you do.
A lot of the early ones I can't remember because I was tripping most of the time.
Yeah, incredible. Oh mate, I'm so excited. Well, I would love to join you, and if not, I'll be in the audience for sure.
Have a listen anyway. Dan, thank you very much for giving up your time, and I hope your rehearsals go well. Can't wait to see you out on the road.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Chris. It's really good to see you.
Keep well. What a fine fella Dan is. He's a real treat, and it was great to get an insight into a musician's life, especially their formative years. And whilst Mike Rutherford's parents had no music in the house, Dan clearly did. But they both ended up making huge selling concept albums, so maybe it all comes from within after all. And I can see a lot of parallels between Dan and myself. We're both fascinated by David Bowie and telling stories within our songs. The thing that we don't have in common is I've never been on stage using a loop pedal, but there's always time to learn. You can discover how to support Help Musicians, and you can find them on all social media platforms, or you can go to their website at helpmusicians.org. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.